ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः शृणुयाम देवाः, भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः, स्थिरैरङ्गैः स्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः व्यसेम देवहिदं यदायुः. स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः, स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः, स्वस्ति नस्ताक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः, स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु. ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. सो दिस् इस् दि फीस् इन्वोकेशन् आफ् दिस् मन्त्र दट् यु आर् रिपीटिङ्ग् एट् द वेरि बिगिनिङ्ग् आफ् दिस् क्लास्. And yesterday there was a request to give a detailed exposition, explanation of this piece chant. Now first, this is a prayer to God, the Almighty, who is immanent in all of us and also who is the all-pervading reality, for blessings, so that we can lead a happy, meaningful life. Happy not only in spiritual aspect, but also in material aspect. So you find a prayer for long life, a healthy body, healthy mind, so that this body-mind complex could be used as a useful instrument for leading a spiritual life. So that is the emphasis here. You find a prayer for secular prosperity, which includes health, both mental health and physical health. Prasannatmendriya manaha swasthaita vidhiyate. This is the Ayurvedic definition of perfect healthy-mindedness. Health not only in the physical aspect, but also in the psychological aspect. When our body doesn't remind you of its existence, if the body doesn't complain, I'm here, shouting loudly, it means you have to go to the doctor. That means if the body doesn't remind you of its own existence, your mind actually transcends the body. That's the state of perfect bodily health. This is from Sushruta Sutras. Sushruta was a great medical scientist of ancient India. Charaka, Sushruta and Vagbhada. Of these three, the later one, Vagbhadacharya, who is the author of the Ashtanga Hridaya, the Bible of modern Ayurveda, he was a Buddhist actually. He was a good Buddhist scholar who wrote this book. So this particular definition is from Sushruta Sutta, Sutras. I mean Sushruta Sutras, aphorisms, small pithy statements expounding perfect healthy-mindedness and also bodily health. Now prasannatmendriyama, I mean prasanna, you know what is prasanna? Prasanna is fully satisfied. You are perfectly in a state of natural restfulness. Spontaneous, inner, natural restfulness. And you will be pleasant. Atma here means body. Body, mind and senses. That's why yesterday I was mentioning, you know, Atma in Ayurveda frequently means body also. So body is an instrument for leading a purposeful, meaningful life. So that we can, it's not an exclusively spiritual definition. Like the Upanishads, which is a spiritual text. Here, the definition is an all-round definition of human life as a whole, both secular and also spiritual. People need material prosperity, money, wealth, status, job, everything. But their pursuit of material prosperity should not violate certain fundamental principles called dharma. So, artha and kama are the second and third values. But these two values mean artha means the means, the methods, the instruments that you use for leading a happy, prosperous material life, wealth, education, and so on. Kama means our goals, our plans, our schemes, that we are trying to attain, or to achieve in life. For that we need so many things. People need so many things. They need job, they need wealth, they need many other things. So we must work for them. But our pursuit of these means for attaining our life goals should not violate certain fundamental principles of ethics and righteousness. And these values together preserve human life and sustain human life. These values are put together under the name dharma. So that's the meaning of dharma. Dharma is what preserves. The root of the word dharma is called dhru, dharidi, that which supports, preserves, sustains. Suppose if something is falling, it supports from falling down, sustains its health so that it doesn't suffer problems, preserves, it's not lost. So dharma is the first foundational value based on which people work for their material comforts. And when they pursue these life goals, without deviating from the path of dharma, then what happens? You reach a point where you think of some higher value, higher than those values that give you material happiness. That value is liberation, moksha. I mean the real meaning of life. What's the meaning of life? If life nothing but a journey that begins with birth and enjoying and suffering for 100 years, and ending, coming to an end when the body is pushed through the tube, finally culminating in a piece of stone in the cemetery where you go every year, the descendants go every year, put flowers. Is that life? So Vedanta says no. It is only a semicolon or a comma, not a full stop. But for that we must practice dharma. The dharma is one important value to understand the meaning of the Shanti Mantra. The second value is satya. Satya is the philosophical dimension of dharma. Dharma is the practical aspect of the highest form of spiritual life. Life as a whole, not only spiritual. Secular, material life, all included. So this is a very important point to remember. Vedanta is not a message for leading spiritual life alone, not at all. It is not a message of asceticism or life negation. Rather, it is a message for complete life. So when you lead such a life, when you reach a point, you think of some higher fundamental supreme values which make our life meaningful, which gives a kind of meaningfulness or relevance of life. So then we think of moksha or liberation, trying to come out of this veil of birth, life and rebirth, and again continuing this gate, this veil of what we call samsara, which is used in Buddhist tradition also, pradhitya samutpada, samsara, coming out of the veil when we understand our true nature. And that aspect is called supreme value, moksha. So, now, and how to achieve this goal? A philosophical discussion is included in the discussion of satya. And then there is a third value which is very important to understand this anti mantra, the rhythm. Rhythm is the kind of cosmic order, a cosmic order that harmonizes life in a individual life and also cosmic existence. Both are not unrelated, in fact. They are interdependent and interrelated facts. So you find there is an invisible but strongly, intensely felt law that operates behind everything, which is perhaps much more scientific, much more infallible than Newtonian law or the discoveries of Einstein or the modern physicists, because many of these discoveries get updated. They don't turn out to be false, but some higher discoveries are made, so there is a modification, there's an updating process. So its relevance is perhaps it takes a back seat. As human pursuit of the mystery of nature progresses, discoveries and laws of science of yesterday become less relevant today, and today's discoveries become less relevant of a much less significance tomorrow. So it goes on changing. But these laws don't change. Law of karma is one of them. So there's an invisible cause-effect link. And this cause-effect link evolves a subtle, invisible principle, a law of harmony that harmonizes life as a whole and also the life of the cosmos. If you cut down trees, there will be less rainfall, deforestation can cause less rainfall, drought and maybe famine, miseries for humanity. If you build a dam without any discrimination across all the rivers, the natural flow of the river, which is part of the this kind of inner harmony, the inherent principles of sequence and harmony that nature or cosmos follow. So it will be violated. So that it's against dharma. It means it's against dharma to cut down trees or to pollute air and water, because that will violate this rhythm. The Sanskrit Rigvedic term is rhythm. So rhythm, the word rhythm is sometimes used as a synonym of dharma and satya, and sometimes as different. So ruthena, satyena, they're both are nouns and adjectives. Nama and vishesha, nama, visheshana and nama mean nouns and adjectives. But ruthamcha, satyamcha, both are equally different categories. Totally two different distinct categories. So often these are used as the same, in the same sense, or sometimes with different senses. So this prayer, you have to remember one thing, this prayer belongs to an age of early Vedic age where they did not think of a monotheistic creator god whom they can worship or pray to in a temple or a church or in a place of worship. There was no image worship, and there were not established temples in those days, in the early Vedic age. So spirituality was taught, studied and transmitted through teacher succession tradition, mostly in the Vedic hermitages. Great sages lived and they taught students who came from different parts of the world, and taught them this Vedic teaching, gave them this Vedic teachings, imparted Vedic teachings. Sometimes emperors and princes, aged people, retired people, sometimes small children also assembled in these Vedic hermitages. Education was free, and there was no tuition fees, and there was no paycheck for the teacher either. So it was all more of a teacher-student succession. So they used to look upon natural phenomena as manifestations of the supreme transcendental divinity. The same divine principle expressing in different forms and different ways in our inner life as contentment, purity, and also in the cosmic life as the sublimity or the grandeur or the beauty of natural phenomena. So, and they believed that a divine reality existed behind all these natural phenomena. So these things to be understood. So there was no temple worship and there was no image worship. So the mantra begins like this. It is first, the mantra is addressed to devas. Devas means gods and goddesses who represented the grandeur, the beauty, the majesty of natural phenomena. So they are addressing deva. They mean deva. The word deva is defined by 6th century BC Vedic commentator called Yaska in his Niruktam. Devo Dhanadva Dyutanadva Dyusthanova Bhavati. This kind of dictionary, metrical form more or less. So a deva is a person who resides in our heart, the divine principle, who listens to our prayers, or he is one who whose abode is in the celestial plane and is the one who gives us what we pray for. So is a prayer addressed to these divine entities. What are they praying for? So karnebhihi bhadram vayam sunayama. This is a prose order. So in Sanskrit verses, you know, in Sanskrit grammar, the noun, the adjective, the verb, or the gerund or adverb, it can come anywhere. So that is the interesting aspect of Sanskrit grammar. You do the subject object sequence is totally irrelevant. You can put wherever you want and it will have the same meaning. It is very, very precise, very, very mathematical. So you can start with the object. You can start with a verb. You can start with an adjective. You can start with a preposition. You can start with a prefix or a suffix. Nothing will happen. The same meaning. So there is no rigid law of sequence, chronological order of the word, different words which constitute a sentence. So that's I'm putting in prose order. So that's why. So when you read the text, you don't find in this order. So, O gods and goddesses, let us always hear what is auspicious to us and what is auspicious to the whole humanity. That's our first prayer. So, karnebhihi bhadram vayam sunayama. Vayam means we. See, karnebhi means with our ears. Bhadram means what is auspicious, good for us and also for the whole humanity. So let us always hear with our, always hear words that are auspicious to everyone. The second prayer is, you know, Akshabhi Bhadram. So, now let us always see. Akshabhi means with eyes. Let us always see only those things which are auspicious for us and also for the whole humanity, for the whole creation. Because the world we create is mostly the world that we create with our eyes and ears. Other senses play much less significant roles. So the world that we live in, that we interact with, of which we are a part, is the world that is created by our eyes and by our ears. And they constitute the memories. So when we remember, that also is a recreation of what we have experienced seeing and hearing. Because the mind flows towards the external objects through eyes and ears. So, let us see only good things in this world. Good for us and good also for the humanity. For that we need God's blessing. So, this is a kind of prayer. first prayer. So we have to remember, you know, these prayers are found in all Upanishads. But for every Upanishad, there is a particular kind of prayer that is normally recommended. This particular prayer, Bhadram Karnebhi, that particular prayer is found in the Taittiri Aranyaka. It is found in Samaveda. It's also found in the Rigveda. So Taittiri Aranyaka is part of Yajurveda tradition. So you find this in the Taittiri Aranyaka, which is Yajurveda, Yajurvedic tradition, in the Samaveda and also Rigveda. But actually this Upanishad that we are discussing belongs to Atharva Veda. So in a way it is so universal. That's the idea behind. So and Yajatraha mentioned here. Yajatraha literally it means we are always contemplating on meditating on the supreme reality. So when we lead a life of contemplation and meditation, let us be blessed with that power to see good and to see experience, to see good and to hear good and experience only those things which are auspicious, which mean well for the whole creation. That's the idea behind. Then, Akshabhi Bhadram. So, and let us always realize the supreme reality. Next, next prayer is for health. Stirehi Angehi means let us our body be physically healthy, because physical health is an important part, it is an instrument. So that's an important point to remember. Body is important not because body is great. Body helps you to transcend body. Body helps you to do spiritual practice, which will help you to go beyond body. So for that you need an instrument. So when you cross the ocean, you need a boat. But once you cross the ocean, you don't carry it on your head. You leave it behind. So this imagery is used in many of the scriptures in Shankaracharya's commentary. Nobody carries a boat in his head. It's a worshipping, becoming a worshipper of one's own body is like carrying the boat in your head. So that's the idea behind. It's only an instrument, dharma sadhanam. So Kalidasa calls it, Kumara Sambhava is an ancient classic of Kalidasa. There is a very interesting story. Anyway, there are two parts of the story. I won't refer to the earlier part. When goddess Parvati was meditating and she wanted Shiva to become her husband. Shiva is the lord of ascetics, knowledge. So that is a big, tall order. Now this is so, she meditated for thousands of years in mythology. See, mythology is important only because it has got a message behind. Other myths and mythologies have no real significance, bereft of their inner implication. Anyway, so she was meditating with the one purpose of getting the Lord of Ascetics to be her husband. So he wanted to test her. After thousands of years. He didn't bother, he didn't listen. Then he took the form of an ascetic himself and came to her and told her things which are not so very complimentary about Shiva. Wanted to test her faith. But she was not impressed. Then he also said that, it comes in the Kumara Sambhava in the fifth sarga, fifth chapter, so to speak. Says, Apikriyartham sulabham samit kusam jalanya visnana vithikshamanite apisvashaktya tapasi pravartase sarira madhyam khalu dharma sadhanam. Sarira is this body. So there he makes a statement. Actually he is trying to test this great lady ascetic. But what he says is this. He is making inquiry after her welfare. Do you have enough water for your ablutions, for your puja, enough flowers, enough other ingredients necessary for meditation and other spiritual practices? And are you engaged in this ascetic practices by your own will or by your own strength? Can you really succeed? Testing. And then he makes a statement. Remember, this body has got one importance. Mukhyam dharma sadhanam. Adhya means mukhyam, the most important instrument for the body, for the most important instrument for practicing asceticism, for achieving anything noble in life, is this physical body. So a healthy body is important only because it is an useful instrument to reach a goal that transcends body itself. So that definition is the motto of many Ayurvedic scientists. We look after the body. We should not worship the body. We should, but rather, body is an instrument for a higher purpose, spiritual purpose. So here the Vedic sage is praying to God. Let our physical body, the tanubhi means, you know, this physical body, the senses of action, senses of perception, all these, let them be strong, but for a purpose. Sushtuvam saha, because we are meditating on the Supreme God, Supreme Brahman. We are meditating, and when you meditate, when you reach higher level of spiritual achievement, you transcend body consciousness. But for transcending the body consciousness, you need a healthy body. Just as you need a kindergarten to begin your education, it is not of any significance when you go beyond that level. And then, you know, devahidam yat ayuhu. So whatever may be the life span that the gods have permitted us, let that be spent in a proper, useful manner, so that we can act, we can see, we can hear, we can think only auspicious things that will help us to attain our spiritual goal. This prayer is addressed to Indra. Indra is Vruddhasrava, means he has a great reputation. Indra was the supreme of the ancient Vedic pantheon, as mentioned in the Rigveda Samhita. So, Nasosti Dathadu. Let us please bless us with auspiciousness, with all that is good, all that is useful for leading a spiritual life. And then Vishveda Pusha Nasosti. Vishveda, the all-knowing, the supreme, the omniscient God, the God of Earth, Surya, Sun. Let Sun give us always auspiciousness. And also the ancient mythological bird Garuda, who moves fast, he is portrayed as a mighty, fast-moving bird, divine bird. And he was an expert in destroying his enemies. So, just as he is an expert in destroying his enemies, let him bless us with the ability to destroy our inner enemies, inner mental impurities, which are enemies in leading spiritual life. And also, the great teacher of Devas. Devas themselves had a teacher, Brihaspati. Let the Brihaspati also bless us with auspiciousness. These are the prayers, the meaning of the Shanti Mantra. Now, at the end of the Shanti Mantra, you find a word repeated, Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om is, of course, I already explained Om in the beginning of the Mandukya Upanishad. That's the first topic discussed in the first two mantras, Om, Pranava. So there's no need to repeat right now. So three times you find the Shanti is repeated. This is repeated in Buddhist traditions, in many Indian, the Jaina tradition, in some of the Sikh traditions, and also many other traditions. So in the Vedic tradition especially. The word Shanti is repeated. It means peace. Why three times? So there is a significance behind. So it is called Tritapa Shanti. Tapa means miseries, problems, obstacles that we encounter in our life. We encounter many obstacles in our spiritual life. When we turn to spiritual life, when you try to meditate, immediately unnecessary thoughts, ideas, images, impressions come to the surface. And it is a natural experience that when you take to spiritual life, many problems which you perhaps did not think of earlier begin to crop up, to emerge. It's just like we are when you clean up the swamp. So there is a lake with a lot of dirt and filth. When you try to clean up the lake or a well, with a big long stick, you stir it. Without that, you cannot clean it up. But for that, the beginning, you may have to face this problem of many dirt and filth and dust and mud coming to the surface. We have to remove. Then only you'll be able to succeed in cleaning up the lake or the well. So many of these obstacles may come up. So we need protection. That's why this prayer is included in the beginning of discussions in Vedanta. So these obstacles are threefold according to ancient Vedic tradition. They are called Adhyatmika, Adibhautika and Adidaivika. These are Sanskrit terms. I shall try to explain. The first one is Adhyatmika. Adhyatmika is an obstacle. It could be problems related to health. So they called Jwaradi, mean fever or many of the health problems that may come up. So many of these problems were somehow linked to some transcendental cause by the ancient Vedic sages. So everything was interpreted and portrayed and understood to be part of a divine scheme with a divine hand guiding behind. That was the early concept. That's why the rhythm, you know, it's a part of the rhythm concept. The invisible divine hand that regulates and controls life in our personal life and also events in the cosmic existence. Events in the personal life and also the whole cosmic order is being regulated by a transcendental divine hand. So many of these obstacles are called physical, internal problems, you know. Sometimes it could be laziness, mental problems, inertia, or boredom. Or suddenly you don't like it, so you feel, oh, I have some engagement, appointment. It could be manageable still, because the boredom or inertia too much, so that becomes a big event, you know. If we don't have the inertia or laziness, then this becomes more prominent. After all, we do what we consider of the top priority. That's what we do. Everyone does the same. If somebody says you have no study, you have no time for Vedanta or higher spiritual ideas, it means you have plenty of time for many other things. So 24 hours and the energy resources, mental, physical, nervous are the same more or less. So how we divert? So we have a priority, set of priorities. And I'm talking in a very absolute sense at the relative level, you know, there are many problems that we cannot discuss in this context. What I mean to say, there are many unavoidable pressing appointments which are important. But what I mean to say, so many of these problems we can overlook with a prayer. So praying to God to look beyond these problems and to focus on spiritual life. So that's the idea behind a solution to these obstacles. That is Adhyatmika, internal, physical, and so on. Then Adibhautika. Adibhautika, you know, there are problems, natural calamities, earthquakes, or thieves breaking to your homes. Chora Vyagradi, these are two words used in the classical text, which relates to those times. Thief and tigers, wild animals. They were all discussing these ideas in the forest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to pray for protection from wild men and also from wild animals. So it's called Adhi Bhautika, the second kind of obstacles. The third type of obstacles, you know, Adhi Devika. That's they believed in ancient times, they believed there are supernatural beings who are not in good terms with you when you take to higher life. Because the earlier, in the ancient Vedic concept was that these supernatural beings are those who try to practice meditation, prayer, to come out of this veil of samsara, these life cycles, and to reach the eternal liberation. They did not succeed because in the process they acquired many celestial skills. So they became very proud of them. So they fell from the highest perfection. So they became divine beings. Now they are not very divine, they are supernatural beings.
Mm-hmm.
So Yaksha Rakshasadi from the ancient books means all the maybe supernatural beings. Maybe they may be living in other planets, we don't know. Anyway, they have some kind of supernatural skills they used to believe in ancient times, in Vedic age. So please give us protection from those obstacles also. So three types of obstacles. That is the significance of repetition of shanti or peace three times. In a way, in a general way, we can say physical obstacles in the form of physical ailments, or maybe obstacles in the form of some unpleasant events related to unpleasant people whose presence could create obstacles in the retreat place, you know, sometimes, you know. Or it could be the other interpretation, Adhi Devika, supernatural beings, which perhaps you don't need much of a serious discussion in this context. These are three, the meaning of the significance of repeating Shanti three times. I hope it's clear. Okay. So now we'll come to the main text. Okay. I think it's almost more clear, more or less. Okay. So now we'll come to the text proper. So yesterday we were discussing these subjects first. That is, we were discussing this via negativa, or called negative theology, as is found in Eckhartian theology, philosophy, which finds almost a wonderful presentation in this third, fourth millennium BC text. So that's the thing. We already discussed many of these parts. Nanta prakyam, na bhagish prakyam, na ubhayada prakyam, na prajnanaghanam, na prakyam, na prakyam, adishtam, avyavahariam, agrahyam, alakshanam, achindyam, avyapadesyam, ekatma pratesaram, prapanchopashamam, shantam, shivam, advaitam, chaturtham, manyante, sa atma. Savikneha is one of the most famous and celebrated paragraphs, mantras in the Vedic Upanishadic literature. So we already discussed this fourth state, this Atma, the Supreme Reality. It cannot be called either conscious or unconscious, because conscious-unconscious equation can apply only to things of this world. Things belong to the empirical phenomena. So you can call something good and bad, black and white, knowledge and ignorance. All these terms are applicable only to the empirical phenomena, which we interact with the mind and the five senses. And whatever the mind recognizes is a proof, is sure proof that it is not absolutely real. So that point needs a lot of explanation, because it is just the opposite of what we normally think. When I say this glass is there, it is there. Because I can see it when my mind and eyes get focused on the shape of this glass. I can see the form, and I can see, then I can also remember its name. So nama and rupa, name and form, which constitute this relative empirical phenomena. But because it is recognized and understood and comprehended with the eyes and five senses of perception, any of them, for that very reason, it is within the realm of relativity. It is not unreal in the absolute sense, but it is not real in the absolute sense, because if it were real in the absolute sense, this glass and this water would be here after 15 billion years. It won't be there. It is there. An insect may exist for a few seconds. This universe may exist for 13 billion years perhaps. Both are equally unreal in the absolute sense, but real only in the relative sense. So that's the idea. In that sense, good and bad, existence or non-existence, all these we normally use only in the context of relative entities. That's why this indescribable, transcendental Turiya, which is the basis of everything, is beyond description, beyond verbalization. So it is neither conscious nor unconscious, neither the absence of either nor the combination of both. So all possibilities of description, definitions are ruled out. And then it is, you know, it is neither dense with consciousness nor simple with consciousness. And it is not unconsciousness either. It is adrishtam, it is unseen. That's what I mentioned. Unseen means human eyes have not set, no one has set his eyes upon Brahman, because Brahman is invisible, adrishtam. What is seen is only an objectified knowledge. And every objectified knowledge is relative. And yesterday I mentioned avyavahariyam, actionless, it should be understood beyond the very idea of action, inaction, equation. It is neither action nor inaction, neither the combination of both nor the absence of both. Because beyond these four dimensions, language cannot go. So it is the reality where language cannot peep into, human mind cannot peep into. So, ito vacho nivartante apraapya manasasaha in Taittiriya Upanishad, you know, mind and words together went in search of the absolute reality. Mind understood that, well, it's not, I cannot understand it beyond mental comprehension. Words also understood, vacha also understood, I cannot explain this. And they returned empty-handed. So that's the idea behind. So it is incomprehensible. That means it is grahyam alakshanam. It doesn't have any of the signs, of the external signs by which you can subject to scrutiny with any of the epistemological tools in our hand, which I mentioned yesterday, you know, pratyaksha anumana, gumana, sabda, arthavati, anubilabti. Yesterday I explained this. Or if you stretch it beyond that, Sambhava, Aitihya, Cheshta and Parisheshya. These are four additional epistemological tools which are more or less related to the inference, Anumana or Anubhilakti. So I won't, there is no need to go beyond this limit. So it is beyond any kind of epistemological tools. Theory of knowledge cannot define it. Unthinkable, you know, mind cannot go there. So, and again, what is its proof? So, the mantra says, ekatma pratyasaram. Then how do we understand it? There should be a way of understanding. There is. Yesterday I mentioned, you know, the sakshat aparokshat brahma. It is not remote. It is not paradoxa, because it's our true nature, the nearest to us. It's our true nature, our true identity. So it is not remote. It is not direct, not subjected to direct perception, because it is beyond mind, beyond words, beyond the senses of perception. Then what is the proof? Ekarna Pratyasaram. Its proof consists in the identity of the Atman in all states. That means you understand, you listen to Vedic statement that it is omnipresent, it is present in everything. It is present in the waking state, dream state, and deep sleep state as the perceiver, as the subject, as the witness, as the all-knowing subject. And the same subject is present in the Turiya state. And this is a very important, strong logic of Advaita philosopher Shankaracharya. He says, why do we remember dreams? Why do we get a feeling after a long real rest, deep sleep, which everyone is seeking, the only way to get rested? Why do we remember that after coming out of sleep, oh, I had a wonderful rest? The restful experience is over. Right now he may be in the midst of, maybe say standing on the market street, but he can recollect his previous night's experience, had a wonderful rest. And you also remember the dreams. So how are we able to remember the experiences of dreams and the experience of complete restfulness, not during susupti, deep sleep, but after coming out of deep sleep? When you return to waking state, you remember your restful experience. How do we remember? The objects of dreams are vanished, as we know very well. In dream, the objects of waking state do not exist. That's why you really believe and you travel to New York from here in a split second, which you don't do during waking state. So there is a bridge. The bridge not connecting the objects or the experiences, the bridge connecting the experiencer of all the three states. The same person remembers dream objects. We can recollect in the form of memory, we recollect dream experiences. And what is memory? Memory is nothing but re-experiencing. When you sit here with eyes closed or eyes open, when you remember something that happened 10 years back, you remember vividly, you can see in your inner eye, not your outer eye. Mentally you see what you saw, what you went through 10 years back. It's memory. And so memory is not different from dream. That is a famous thesis of Shankaracharya. Memory and dream are the same, of the same quality, or the same degree of reality or unreality, depending upon from which angle you look at it. From the highest, supreme, absolutist standpoint, both dream and waking state are equally unreal. That's what we are going to discuss in the next sessions after this particular mantra is over. So, coming back to the subject, memory is like a dream. Now, how are you able to remember what happened to you last year, or even last day, or yesterday? What you saw yesterday has gone, the objects have gone. But the one who saw that, the witness, the subject, the experiencer, is the same you. And you are today. In the absence of the objects, you are here. So the same witness, the same subject, the same experiencer remains intact in dream state, in waking state, and also in the deep sleep state. But objects, the dream objects, the waking state objects, the experiences of the waking state and dream state have they change from state to state. But there's a connecting bridge. They are the same. It's just like if you are on the house and the house is 3 stories, you can go wherever you want. It's your property. So you don't belong to any of these 3 rooms. You may have your reception desk below. But you can visit as you want. Because you are the one who can go in all the 3 states. So Atma Tiriya can go to, can experience deep sleep state, dream state, and also waking state. It is not limited to one particular state. It transcends all the 3 because it is present everywhere. It is beyond, it is distinct. It transcends all the 3 states. So, once you think of this one great one experiencer, drashta, it's called drashta, or the seer, the experiencer, which consists in all the 3 states, and which is the culminating point of the entire cosmic existence, which is unchanging, which is ever-present, which is auspicious, is non-dual. Once you contemplate on this reality, suddenly you realize, as Swami Vivekananda mentioned in yesterday's lecture, you realize the kingdom that you are searching for is your own kingdom. The one whom you are searching for, your own true self. That is it, Swarajya Siddhi, the Sanskrit text which is used. So, it is a kingdom that we, that actually is our kingdom, and we are not getting a new knowledge. We are not inventing a new truth. We are only discovering what we forgot for some time. So, that's the meaning. And then you know what happens when you realize that prapanchopashamam, then this so-called empirical world of varieties, variations, changes, all will cease to exist. At that state, you transcend this empirical, this level of empirical experience. It's called that way, ekatma prithya saram. That is the one central theme of this intense contemplation of the spiritual seeker who is meditating on the supreme reality, who is present in all the 3 states of waking, dream and deep sleep, and who is present in everything, who is present in us and is all pervading. When you meditate on that, you discover this as your own true self. So it could be understood only through this meditation. Prapanchopashamam, then this empirical phenomena of varieties and differences, contradictions, all will cease to be real. You understand their unreality. But at this stage only, that's why Sri Ramakrishna said, you know, in the highest samadhi, total silence. The language of the infinity silence, the language of finite is, well, you can write volumes on about something that is finite, that is empirical. But the transcendental, you can use, you can write a book, but the language you'll be using will be silence, beyond words. That's the idea behind. Shantam Shivam, it is the most auspicious spiritual goal for everyone to seek. Advaitam, it is one without a second. You can't say one. That will imply a possibility of 2 and 3. So that's why Advaitam means, you know, Vedanta doesn't say one. Vedanta says non-dual. Something other than 2. So that's why Ekam may be used, but Ekam may be accompanied by Advaitam. One without a second. That's idea. Chaturtham manyante sa atma sa vijneha. That is the Atman, that is Brahman, that is the indweller within all of us, that is the supreme reality, the all-pervading reality, the supreme divine reality, which is the basis, the ultimate cause of all the whole existence. This is what you have to search for. This is what you have to realize. Now, how is this done? This also is very important to remember. When you read this text, see, when you read this text, when we get these higher ideas, we get this idea, this message as an idea, as a concept. That is fine. But if it becomes real experience, then you will have an unshakable confidence. Your mind will be always calm. That's why, you know, Swami Vivekananda's famous statement that we have put in our website. If you can, standing or sitting in the market street, can you feel the presence of the divine everywhere? If you feel the presence of the divine only in a temple or a church, and you don't feel its presence outside the place of worship, then you have not reached the ultimate goal. But if you can feel the presence of the divine, even the market street, that we can say, then you feel its all-pervading reality. You don't get this level, you don't reach this level just by reading. Reading has got a great importance, no doubt, it's very, very important. But reading and getting it as an idea is one thing. Reaching that experience is something else. Of course, Sri Ramakrishna put in a simplest possible analogy. A person who goes on shouting milk can't move because he doesn't take nutritious food. But every day he goes on shouting meat, fish, McDonald's hamburger, but he can only shout these names. He doesn't get any benefit. He is still under he's suffering from malnutrition. You have to drink milk and you should have the digestive system that can absorb it. Then only milk be of any use to you. Sri Ramakrishna puts all this in the simplest possible language possible. This is we had an almanac or maybe a weather chart, a book of weather forecasts. We say there will be so much of rains. You squeeze that book, you don't get any drop of water. So, but then you need this book is useful to you. You need a name of milk because then only you can think of one day going to Trader Joe's and buying it. You need the word. But there is a difference between reading about in a newspaper and going to Trader Joe's, buying it, drinking it, as you need and getting nourished. This is a process. So you have to find out a way to reach the Trader Joe's, and then you have to buy the milk, and then you have to measure, you should write the right quantity, you have to drink it. So after getting these instructions, these ideas from books or from a teacher, this right now is only a concept for you, which is just a grand ideal to be attained, to be aimed at, to be sought after. It should come to the level of your own experience. For that there is a process. There are two schools of thought in Vedanta which look upon this process from two different angles without much difference. Of course, these two views evolved after Shankaracharya's time, during the time of his disciples and their disciples, who interpreted Shankaracharya's commentary in various ways. This is called different schools of thought. So one is Sureshwara. He wrote two famous books, many books he wrote, Taishkarma Siddhyams, but one important book he wrote was Brihadaranyaka Upanishad Bhashya Vartikam. It's a huge commentary in verses on Shankaracharya's commentary on Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Another one is Taittiriya Upanishad Bhashya Vartikam. A huge commentary, Vartika means a huge commentary in verses, which is written on the commentary of Shankaracharya on Taittiriya Upanishad. So there are many other books he wrote, Naishkarma Siddhi and so on. So he had one view about this process, that is called Vartika Prasthana. Then Padmapada was another disciple of Shankaracharya, like Sureshwara. He wrote another book. It is called, actually he got Panchapadika. Panchapadika Vivarana was wrote by Sarvajnana Muni, so it became it came to be known as Vivarana Prasthana, the school of Vivarana. And of course, just I shall briefly, it's very important from the spiritual sadhana point of view, practical point of view, that's why I'm referring to this. So you have to remember, of course, altogether more, to be more precise, there are three schools, but I don't want to become too elaborate, especially for those who have not studied complicated Vedantic dialectical polemical works, which are preparatory. Vartika Prasthana is one, Vivarana Prasthana is one, then Bhamadi Prasthana is one. So Bhamadi was a famous book written by Mantena, and Vartika was written by Sureshara, and this Vivarana Prasthana actually is alluded to Padmabhadra, Sarvajnan Muni and others. Anyway, two broad approaches I mentioned. One, according to some philosophers like Sureshwara, Padmapada, two disciples of Shankaracharya, according to them, when you read this in a book or when you listen to your teacher, as Sri Ramakrishna listened to Totapuri, immediately you get the experience of it. But you should remember and listen to this, what I'm going to tell right now, it's very important. According to one school, it's called Vivarana Prasthana, Sureshwara, Padmapada and others, they believed that if you listen to this instruction or read a book, you immediately reach the experience level of it. You know very well that it is not correct as stated. But there is one condition. If you have reached the highest level of spiritual fitness, if you have meditated for 50 years, if you have led a very pure life, mind is very pure, and if you are doing unselfish service, meditation, leading life, like Sri Ramakrishna, let's say, then just if you listen immediately, it becomes an experience to you. For that, you should have already gone through sadhana chadushtaya sampatti. Nitya nitya vastu viveka discrimination between the real and unreal. And total renunciation, no desire for anything of this world or the next. And complete self-control, meditation, and a great desire for liberation. Like Sri Ramakrishna only wanted God, nothing else. For 12 years we meditated, prayed, and there was nothing in his mind except God, Mother. If you can do that, if Totapuri comes and gives one instruction, it becomes an experience. I can explain to you from a very, very practical point of view. Suppose every day you are driving from San Francisco to Lake Tahoe, and Lake Tahoe to San Francisco for 50 years every day. Think of that. And then somebody comes and tells you, on your way from Lake Tahoe to San Francisco, there is a shop in a particular city. There is an exit number. If you are driven for 50 years, twice every day, then the moment somebody tells you about the name of the street, the exit immediately becomes obvious to you. But if you tell me, I won't understand anything because I come only once a year for this retreat. So like that, if a person had practiced meditation or ascetic spiritual practices may for all time, then a single reading will become clear to you. Or if you, I can very well easily understand, say, let us say, a professor, let's say a doctor or an engineer or a professor of language. If he goes to Berkeley Library and reads work by Shakespeare, you don't need somebody else telling you a work by Shakespeare, if he knows that. An engineer, when he has something to do, like the engineering work, becomes obvious to him. Because an engineer for 50 years, a doctor who was a doctor for 60 years, Dr. Card could tell my the real problem of my like study. It doesn't require, because for 60 years we practice, you become familiar with this, the whole terrain, every inch of it. Sri Ramakrishna was familiar with the whole terrain, the whole trail of spiritual life. For 12 years, even before that, from the day he was only 5 years old, when he had the first mystical experience, he was walking the field, paddy field. So the sight, the glorious sight of white cranes, cranes flying against the background of blue sky, dark, was enough for him to reach ecstasy. If you reach that level of perfection, then one statement, if you hear, like Totaburi told Sri Ramakrishna, Totaburi gave Sri Ramakrishna this mantra and it became an experience to him. It is called Shabda Aparokshavada. Means the moment you hear or read, you get the experience. But for that, you need a lot of practice. As I mentioned, every day you drive up and down San Francisco and Lake Tahoe for 50 years, you don't need a long sermon to be told about a place where you have to take an exit. This one view, it's called Shabda Parokshavada. There is another school, it's called Prasankhyanavada. Prasankhyana means meditative practices. So you find the Bhakti Pravanja was a Jnana Karma Samuchevadin, Brahmadatta, Bhakti Pravanja, and Mandana. And related Mandana Mishra, who wrote Brahma City, or he called, of course, the same Mandana became the author of Bhamati Tiga Brahma Sutras. According to him, just listening won't do. You get instruction from a teacher, then you have to practice. Ekatma Pratyasara means you have to go on contemplating for many, many years and you have to practice this karma, karma, unselfish duty. When you look upon all that you do, physically, mentally and verbally, as an offering to God, when every word that you utter becomes a sacred mantra, when everything you see in the world becomes an expression of the divine, the whole world becomes an expression of God, when the secular, all secular activities merge with the spiritual ideal, and this when you practice for a very long time, then that instruction that you receive today will become an experience 50 years later or many years later. That is true in any teacher, I can tell you. When you teach something with some students, and if the student immediately understands what you teach, it means every day he's getting private tuition. Maybe his parents are teachers who are teaching him privately. So you teach the classroom, immediately becomes clear to him because he's familiar with that as you are driving up and down San Francisco and Lake Tahoe. So when you teach, it becomes clear to him. But there are students whose parents are not teachers, maybe first generation learners. They won't understand immediately when you teach the classroom. They have to listen carefully. And then later on, they have to go on practicing, read again, understand, think. Finally, the meaning of what you teach today becomes clear to the student maybe after some years. So what you teach now becomes really clear, like an idea becoming an experience, maybe after a long time, after a lot of years of hard work, preparation and discussion, debates. It's called Prasankhyanavada, which meant for those who have now reached the highest degree of spiritual fitness, like Sri Ramakrishna. For people like Sri Ramakrishna, just one instruction from a teacher is enough to take them to the highest peak of experience. For those who are not ready or not reach this level of fitness, they will have to listen carefully with a sense of sanctity and total concentration and application, and then they have to practice reading, thinking of it, contemplating it, and also practicing that ideal. Then the experience dimension of this instruction becomes their experience maybe after some time, after some years of practice. So we will have interaction now, and I think we have got 15 minutes, so you can ask questions. If there's not enough time today, tomorrow also you can continue the discussion of what we discussed today.
Your lecture was super. I understood most of the things I know. Because sometimes I dream that I never saw those people or I never went that place. And I have no idea what is the meaning. And then I always feel from my childhood that I was in, when I was in Ritika, I was in Gwalior, then in Assam, in Calcutta, in America, and you know, I felt that I and those people I left behind, I never saw them. So I always feel that I born that time, again I die, again I born, again I die, and throughout this year I change also myself. So in this life, I always feel I born so many times and I die so many times and I born again. I don't know. That is, I always feel.
You think of yourself, at least as an idea right now, as a divine being who is beyond this psychophysical mechanism that is subjected to birth and death. So once you concentrate on that, then the meaning of this becomes clear. So instead of trying to count the number of sand grains in the seashore, taking every one in your hand, which will never come to an end, you take one sand grain and you go to the laboratory and find out what it is, its property. Then you can get a clear understanding of the whole vast seashore. So you, right now, as an idea, as a concept, it may be clear to you, as you mentioned. So if you can look upon yourself as something that goes beyond the psychophysical mechanism, which is born and maybe vanish after 100 years, let us say. If you can think of it, then the meaning or the relevance of all these experiences, this micro dimension of your existence becomes clear to you. We should not think, we should not chase every single dream or every single minute experience that we go through. That's very important to remember. If you think of all these minor experiences and focus your whole mind on these to find a meaning for it, then there is no end to that. So you have to look beyond all these little experiences. Everyone has got these experiences. Not only that, there is a great problem. If you chase these experiences, so much of tenacity, there is one problem, there will be no peace of mind. Peace of mind comes only when you get the overall picture. Upanishad itself is a bhuma vaisukam.
But I don't chase them.
But you are chasing, that's why you remember to mention in the class. If your mind had not contemplated on these things a number of times, you won't be remembering it today. Something that occurred long back, which you never really brought back to your memory system, you won't remember now. You'll be remembering only these mantras. So these memories create a dark cloud, which come back again and again. So the only way out is to look beyond. Remember, mind can never become quiet. Memories, impressions, ideas will come one after another. You can never have any control on what thought is going to emerge in your mind next split second. You have a lot of control. You can decide whether you should take the right turn or left turn. You are driving. It's a physical activity over which you have a lot of autonomy and control.
But those memories are all very happy memories.
Happiness? Yes, you know, well, yeah. If they are all happy memories, there won't be a problem.
Yeah,
then you won't. Then you won't. Then
problem.
Yeah. Then you won't think of bringing it right now, because that happy memory will help you to go deeper into these ideas. So if memory is a helpful memory, then those memories will not emerge again and again. See, it's an interesting thing. Whenever a memory comes back again and again, that memory is not 100% happy. 100% happy memories do not come up again and again. Even if those memories have a happy exterior, there will be some underlying unhappiness. Otherwise, they won't cope up. That's how mind works. Nobody gets sick of remembering happy memories. And happy memories do not prevent us from going deeper into these subjects. And if you go deeper into these, even this memory, you won't consider this memory as worth mentioning even. So what you should do, you should think of yourself as something that goes beyond this memory. Memory is at the level of mind and intellect, antakarana. So the memory system is part of the four compartments which consist of antakarana, internal organs, mind, intellect, that is mana, buddhi, chitta and ahankara. Chitta is the memory system. And chitta retains, accumulates these memories. Because you consciously want to think of them. Otherwise these memories will not come up. There are two kinds of memories that will bother you. One, certain memories that you want to think about, which are happy memories. And certain memories you don't want to think about, they also come to you. Either extreme attachment or liking for some events, or extreme aversion or other, these two only create. Then only these memories which come up again and again in our mind belong to either of these categories. So, and both happy memories and unhappy memories are equally a great impediment in spiritual life, higher spiritual life, and higher devotion also. See, I see, devotional philosophy, it may be more to your taste, may I say. Suppose you look upon everything as a grace of God, an expression of the grace of God, as a part of God's will, then you won't take them as a big deal to worry about. Even a serious tragedy, people can forget if they can think it's in God's will. So happy memories, people never bother about. So if you are a devotee, should think of everything as a will of God, as an act of God's grace, then the memory can be shut out. Memory will not be shut out, memory will not be a problem. The moment a memory comes, you just neutralize it, oh, it's God's will. Immediately, disturbing effect is neutralized. So that's what you should think. Okay. Anybody reply, please?
Yeah, I agree with this,
Ashish.
The other thing might be, whenever such thoughts or memories come, replace it with the thought of the God.
Yeah,
that's where the mantra helps.
Yeah, exactly. Any other discussion from anybody?
Okay, I'm trying to reconstruct this idea. You postulate something that is beyond the perception of the mind.
Yeah.
Okay, so by what means is it to be perceived?
So, I tell you. Now, when you get these ideas, of course, with mind and intellect, you perceive these ideas. And when your mind becomes completely saturated with this great idea, and when it is accompanied by the practice of meditation, contemplation, and supported by good deeds, auspicious deeds, virtuous practice of higher virtues, like unselfishness and so on, then what happens, you know, this idea which you perceive with your mind, it goes deeper into the mental system, then your mind itself becomes completely saturated with this idea. Then mind is no more the mind. Mind, by definition, as we understand in Vedanta, it functions as sankalpa and vikalpa, means a positive thoughts and a contrary thoughts. Mind is nothing but the dimension of mental or impressions. Impressions which can be grouped under two categories. It could be different categories, but for a simple example, you think of certain things in a particular way, extreme, happy, liking, and so on. And the same idea, you may think in the opposite way. So this is what is called mind. So mind is not a solid entity. But with this mind, if you get an idea, spiritual idea, and you try to contemplate and meditate, after long years of practice, this mind will have changed a lot. This mind will lose its original property of speculations, conflicting thoughts and impressions. At that stage, there is a particular statement in the Sanskrit, amani bhava, means mind ceases to be mind as we understand it under normal circumstances. So what's the difference between the mind of a great spiritual person and the mind of an ordinary person? The mind of a great spiritual person is one with Atman. Atman completely reflects on the mind which is pure. Then it is no more mind. It is Atman. That's why Ramana Maharshi said, when mind is turned outward, it is the world. Mind is dragged into different objects by the eyes, by the ears, by the smell of touch, by the sense of touch, sense of smell, and the sense of taste. Mind is being dragged into external experiences, objects, when mind is turned outward. When mind is turned inward, it is no more mind, it is Atman. Mind cannot be really completely turned inward unless we reach the highest peak of spiritual fitness. It takes several decades of contemplation, meditation. And at that, when mind is turned inward, it is no more mind. It is Atman. So that is a problem with they ask in Western psychology and Western philosophy. They raise this objection. Very often this practice is not fully explained to them. They ask, if you say Atman is beyond mind, then how do you understand it? Because the idea of mind transcending itself is not acceptable in modern psychology or Western philosophy. Of kind, of course, thing in itself. You see, there is something beyond this relativity. But then, it was again an intellectual speculation. It is not something. This is not a state to be reached at the experience level. So that should be understood. Mind is mind only when its functions are divided into two categories: conflicting groups of impressions and thoughts. One is, of course, the classical example will make it very clear. When you see an object at a distance, that there is not enough light, you may mistake that object to be a human form. One part of the mind is a human being. Another part of the mind will say, oh, it's a stone pillar, or maybe many things. When you reach, you understand it is a stone pillar, whatever it is. So, coming back to mind, mind is mind only when it's speculating, going through conflicting impressions and thought currents. When mind becomes calm and quiet, and it becomes completely calm and quiet, when it is linked to Atman, and when it's linked to Atman, mind is no more mind. Mind is Atman itself. So there is an ascent from mind to non-mind. Yeah.
Swami, I thought that Craig's question was very good, and I know the way I heard it was,
ultimately, who is the perceiver?
Yeah.
Who is it
yeah.
knows and recognizes?
Yeah.
And it seems to me that if we can, you know, in addition to what you said, that we could just, in our meditation, acknowledge more and more that the Atman is the I. The Atman is the knower, is the subject, is the one who is conscious. And if we just keep stepping away from this false
yeah.
sense of ourselves as having a mind, as having a separate self apart from the Atman, and just keep saying the Atman is the subject, Brahman is the subject, even if we don't see it very clearly, just to keep saying that, as we heard Swamiji say last
yeah.
night, just
yeah.
keep saying,
yeah.
I am he, I am he, I am not this little finite
yeah.
Mind-body
yeah.
mechanism.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a little long answer, but I just wanted to add that.
Yeah. Okay, now this is exactly what the Upanishad says, you know. I told you, Upanishad says, you know, Ekatma Pratyaya Saram. Ekatma Pratyaya, you know what's Ekatma Pratyaya? Ekatma Pratyaya, one should contemplate on the fact, on this Pratyaya, the knowledge, the conviction, the Atma is one. The Atma is one, I am that Atman. We should contemplate on this single preposition, Ekatma Pratyaya Saram. Then prabhanchopashamam. Prabhancho, I mean prabhancha, the world, empirical world, ceases to exist. That's exactly what is meant by amani bhava in Sanskrit. The empirical world that you perceive with our normal mind ceases to exist. And at that moment, we transcend this mind. This mind ceases to exist as we understand it. And then we transcend the mind. Now the point is, the main problem, you know, mere contemplation, mere remembering and mere contemplation on this can never take us to this idea. Because to be able to concentrate on this contemplation, on this ideal, our mind should be first of all fed with good impressions. If a normal person begins to meditate, and we, I am the Atman, if he says, after a few minutes or seconds, his mind will be disturbed by conflicting thought currents. Mm-hmm. So how to fight these conflicting thought currents? So it is not possible for us to be able to focus on this Atman, I am the Atman, Atman is one, unless it is supported by a mind which has reached its highest peak of purity. And how does mind reach this level of purity? Right now, mind has got good impressions and bad impressions. That's why conflicting thought currents come to the mind the moment you close your eyes. You need not even meditate. You go to seashore, you are alone, close your eyes, try to think of something. It is not one impression alone that comes to the mind. Multiple impressions come to the mind. Some of them helpful, some of them really hostile and unhelpful. Now, how to fight these unhelpful impressions? Unhelpful impressions are the residual effects of unhelpful, undesirable activities. So mind is nothing but a bag. It consists of good and bad thought currents and impressions. The first stage is, we should have a predominance of good thoughts and good ideas. And that will completely neutralize the effect of the influence of bad ideas. And when we accumulate a lot of good impressions, good vrittis and vasanas and samskaras, the mind will cooperate with you when you meditate. And when the mind begins to cooperate with you, then the concentration becomes real. Otherwise, we think we can mentally focus on something and that we become. It really happened. What we focus upon, we become only when the mind is ready. When mind is ready, it's all possible. See, look at Sri Ramakrishna. When Sri Ramakrishna didn't have any problem meditating, he sat there, he was in samadhi. But there is nothing else in his mind. Empirical vritti is, worldly vritti is zero. Spiritual vritti is 100%. So he has to sit. The moment he can think of God. If you reach that level of purity, then you read, even if you go to Berkeley University and read Tattvamasi, because all right, fine. It becomes an experience to you. If Sri Ramakrishna goes to Berkeley University and reads the Upanishad, then one statement, even reading one statement, will take you to experience. But you become Sri Ramakrishna first of all. 12 years, he did nothing but meditate upon God. He did not see when the sun rose in the east, when the sun set in the west. And people had to push food into his mouth. So if you can reach that level of mental fitness, everything is fine. That's why, you remember, in the Saint Teresa of Avila, of course, you know, I should finish this because there's a bit. See, Saint Teresa of Avila talks about the preparation of mind, not for Advaita, but for God's grace.
Yes.
And she says, she gives the example, a marvelous example, of a gardener trying to irrigate the field. The field is right now full of weeds, grass, stones and pebbles. There are many ways of irrigating the field. There is a river flowing nearby. There is a wells. You could have brought water. You could have cut a canal. You used water mill medieval times. You know. That's what she mentions in autobiographical writings. There are many various ways of bringing water to the field. One point, the field should be cleaned up. So you should remove all the weeds and grass and stones, dirt and filth before bringing water. Otherwise, you know what happens? More weeds and grass will grow. So, and then suppose somebody has taken the trouble to clean the field, make it ready for irrigation, and suddenly it starts raining, God's grace comes, it becomes fully irrigated. But if it starts raining before the field is ready, rains will come, but more grass, more weeds will grow. That's very important. So, mind should be ready. Then the rainfall will be a great help. Then, of course, there is a... I can give another example, the counter example. And that comes from Indian mythology. That's very important. There was a demon, his name was Bhasmasura. He was a very wonderful fellow. He had tremendous power of concentration. As you know, mind ready, very healthy fellow. And meditated. Meditated means what? Maybe a scientist trying to produce a weapon of mass destruction, let us say. Something like that he did. Scientist is meditating actually in the laboratory.
Yes.
Trying to apply his powers to build a weapon of mass destruction. This fellow was doing, he meditated. Years of pray to God. The God came, and as an obligation, he was making, calling his name, so he was obliged to come. What do you want? He was a tricky fellow, you know, not a good sort of person. He wanted, you please give me this boon. What's a boon? Whomever I touch with my right hand, if I place my right hand on somebody's head, that person should die immediately. That's the boon he wanted. Remember, he worked very hard. So, a scientist may work very hard to create a weapon that could destroy the world, whole world. Scientists also are meditating. This demon also was meditating in different level. So, he got this and God was forced to, okay, go ahead. Then the demon thought, so whom should I trust? So, he tried to test this on the very God who gave him this boon. So God was running all over the world. This demon chasing him with his upraised hand. Because he wanted to test the teacher himself. Because you know whether it's really genuine or not. So what happened, you know? That's a story, of course. Later, you know, another God came, helped him, and told this demon, see, you are such a fool. This God gives this kind of boon to so many people. It never really works. Otherwise, you test it on your own head. And he put his hand on his own head. He died. So, remember, this man also tried to meditate. But he meditated not with a pure mind. He was not meditating for a higher goal. So it brought his own destruction. That's why you find stories, people who practice, I don't really want to say, meditation in yoga should be taken up only after you are fully well established in certain fundamental disciplines called Yama and Niyama. Ahimsa, Satya, Asteya, Brahmacharya, Parigraha, Sauja, Sandosha, Tapaswadhyaya, Isha, Pridhana. Non-violence, non-stealing, absolutely no desire, no greed for other people's things, pure life, inner contentment, or purity, all these are essential. And also resignation to God's will. All these are values that one should practice before he really takes up meditation. Even if we do not have these qualities, if we sincerely can resign ourselves to God's will, then all these virtues come automatically to us. Because that God orientation, spiritual orientation, will automatically create all these virtues. Before that, we cannot meditate. We think we meditate. You know why conflicting thought currents come? Because we are not well established in Yama Niyama. It doesn't mean that we should not meditate. Not at all. It doesn't mean. But it gives a very scientific, psychological explanation for contemplation. That's why every contemplation is an attempt to intensify, to strengthen our inner resources, energy resources, intellectual resources. But before we generate these energy resources, we should make our mind ready. Otherwise, these resources will be turned into wrong channels. So that's why meditation is okay, but meditation takes you to experience when we meditate after acquiring all these qualities of spiritual fitness. The grandest example is Saint Teresa of Avila. You know, the field should be ready. Remove all the weeds, all the grass, and then you irrigate field, and you get a good crop. Otherwise, you get only weeds and grass. It's okay. Thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.